Thank you so much for joining me once again on the Southern Report. I'm very grateful when you join me. I'm very grateful for the time that you give and to following me. If you have not subscribed, please do so. It'd be much appreciated. One of the wonderful things about traveling is you meet lots of incredible people, and some of those people become friends that you very much appreciate. Through that, you then get to meet others, and then we learn about other events. One of the biggest events that has happened in the last 4 years is what happened on January the 6th, 2021, and the implications of that event for a lot of people, e.g. 1,600 people that were arrested for what happened on January the 6th. I feel very privileged now because I'm going to bring on Stuart Rhodes of the Oath Keepers. We have so much to discuss, and I'm going to bring on Stuart now. Stuart, lovely to meet you via the digital medium. We have a number of mutual friends, as you know, and I very much appreciate your time. And Stuart, I want to start off. There are so many things to discuss. I'm just going to put my glasses on. And I want to read your bio, if I may. Is that okay with you?
Sure.
Right, thank you. So, Stuart, U.S. Army paratrooper, disabled veteran, airborne long-range reconnaissance unit, disabled in a night jump while doing rough terrain parachuting. Ex-firefighter, Yale Law graduate, Yale Law research scholar, worked on D.C. staff of Congressman Ron Paul, clerked for Arizona Supreme Court. Founder of Oath Keepers, Association of Military Police, Firefighters, EMS, 40,000 members at its peak. Innocent J6 political prisoner, didn't enter Capitol, didn't fight with police, targeted for his speech. Held in solitary confinement for over a year, including pre-trial. Refused to plead guilty to a crime he didn't commit. Refused to bear false witness against President Trump. Maintained his innocence through a DC show trial, stayed 100% loyal to our country and to President Trump, sentenced to 18 years, served 3 years in prison, including 1 year of solitary confinement, commuted by President Trump January the 20th, 2025, praying for a full pardon, now has a hard application into U.S. pardon attorney Ed Martin, lawyer Peter Tichtin is his attorney for his pardon application. Currently the national spokesman for Condemned USA, helping other political prisoners and oppressed Americans. A good example of the lawfare continues is Tina Peters in Colorado. Stuart, I would like to thank you for your service, and I would like to thank you for being there on January the 6th, 2021. And I'd just like to say this to you personally, and I've said this statement before, that on that day, the thousands, if not millions of million patriots that turned up weren't just representing the citizens of the United States of America. They were representing many of us around the rest of the world who are patriots, who believe in freedom, who believe in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and fully support what the Constitution of the United States actually stands for. I'm not saying that for hyperbole. I have said it on a number of times, and I'm fully aware of what happened then after. And in your case, as you say, 18 years, etc. So, Stuart, do you mind if can we start with that?
Sure.
In regard to what unfolded for you, because as you said, you were arrested for what you have said, what you have stood for.
Right. Well, actually, identity crime. So with January the 6th, both the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys were targeted because of who we are, mm-hmm. and because we were already on the watch list and already, you know, considered enemy of the regime of the deep state. And so they've been demonizing us and doing the best to marginalize us and cancel us leading up to January 6th. So on January, even though members of Oathkeepers and Proud Boys did nothing different than all the others, 1,500 other people, we were targeted for seditious conspiracy. The only people charged with that crime were members of Oathkeepers and Proud Boys. And the best way to look at this is that there was a coup in 2020. I call it the COVID coup. They used COVID as their excuse to directly violate state election laws across the United States and multiple states, especially in the swing states. And that, of course, triggered a violation of Article 2 because they didn't go to the state legislature to do this. Article 2 is very clear that it's the state legislature alone that can determine the manner for selecting electors. So instead, they used judges in the states and they used executive branch election officials in a very, very well coordinated plan. Later, they did a what I would call a limited hangout in a Time magazine article written in February of 2021. They openly admitted that there was a very well planned, very well orchestrated conspiracy among them to set aside the state election laws using COVID. So they have openly admitted, but they called it how we save democracy. So that's the backdrop, is that they committed a coup in 2020. They were an open insurrection across the country, burning down cities, declaring sovereign territory of Chaz and Chop, killing people. The left was an open rebellion. And then they used that chaos, along with COVID-19, to justify directly violating the election laws, to have wide open mail-in ballots. It's flooded, basically stuffed the ballot box with all these mail-in ballots and exempted. There were multiple states where they just completely set aside the normal process for signature verification and also deadlines for mail-in ballots. And then they have the unsecured drop boxes. That's the reality. They pulled a coup. President Trump should have won that election. He was actually the actual winner. It would have been a fair election. I believe he would have won. But they installed their puppet Biden, who I condemned from the outset of it with a Chi-Com puppet, because he is. His family's been on the payroll of communist China, the tune of millions of dollars through his son, Hunter. So that's the reality. So what they did is they wanted to distract from this classic projection. They accuse you of what they're doing. They pulled a coup, so to cover for it, distract from it, they accused the President Trump and his followers of attempting a coup, an insurrection. So that's why they had to take January the 6th and turn it into something it wasn't. And I consider January the 6th a manipulated event. The protest was very real and very legitimate. As you said, millions of Americans protested. And we had done so in November, big, huge rally in D.C. in November. In December, another massive rally, and then January the 6th. And they were all very similar. In each one of those rallies, there were people who rallied down by the White House, Freedom Plaza, and on the Mall, and then marched to the Capitol for additional events all around the Capitol. And in November and December, there were permitted events all around the Capitol, and on January the 6th were other permitted events. People had applied for permits and pulled permits to have events around the Capitol. That's why we were there. On January the 6th, Oathkeepers was a volunteer security for two permitted events on Capitol grounds. One was the Ali Alexander event. We stopped the Still Rally right outside the east doors on the east side of the Capitol, which is right between the Capitol and the Supreme Court right there. That's where Ali Alexander was having his event. We were going to be security for that event. And then one block north was the other event by Latinos for Trump in what's known as Area 7, which is right next to the Senate office buildings. On Capitol grounds, in a park next to the Senate office building. That's why we were there on January 6th. We'd also done the same exact thing in November and December, protected events on Capitol grounds, speakers and VIPs, and also doing general escort duties for Trump supporters back to their hotels, back to the metro stop, or to a cab. Because Antifa, all through the entire Trump administration, has raged through the streets of the United States, all over the country, including in Washington, D.C., and attacked Trump supporters. And so the backdrop for Washington, for D.C. on January 6th is we had been in Washington, D.C. 9 prior times to do security for events in D.C. because of Antifa. In fact, the first time we did security mission in Washington, D.C. was on January 20th, 2017, on President Trump's first inauguration day. So that's the backdrop for January 6th. That's why we were there.
Stuart, what... At the high point, as you pointed out in the information that you very kindly shared with me and in your bio, that at the height, the membership of the Oath Keepers was 40,000. Could you give a brief history of the Oath Keepers, how long that has been going, and the future of that? I think that would be a very good point to start at.
You bet. Well. Sure. I started Oath Keepers in 2009. I'd worked on the Ron Paul campaign for president in 2008, and I watched that nomination. He should have won the nomination. You know, we were well organized across the country and taking over the GOP from the inside out. Ron Paulers were taking it over. But the GOP establishment cheated at our state nominating convention for the delegates to go to D.C. I watched it in person. I was on the platform committee there, and I was a state delegate to the state convention. And we were going to sweep the delegates, and they just smacked the gavel and said, oh, we're out of time. We can't use this room anymore. It was in a 24-hour casino in Reno, so it was a complete hole. We went to the front desk and said, can we use the room some more? Like, sure, go right ahead. But by that time, all the John McCain people had fled the building to deny us a quorum. And they said, oh, we'll reconvene at a later time. They never did. They just picked their own delegates. So I got a pretty good window into the corruption of deep state right there. Even our own political party, I suppose the political party, the Republican Party, is rotten to the core with corruption. So that's why I started the Oath Keepers. I had lost faith already. I served as a, you know, like you said, a Yale Law graduate. I served as a law clerk for the Arizona Supreme Court. And then I worked as a criminal defense attorney in small town Montana. But I lost faith in our criminal justice system entirely. And I also lost faith in our political system. So that's why I started the Oath Keepers. I wanted to focus on the men with the guns, the ones who would be given orders to violate the people's rights. So I focused on military, police, and first responders like firefighters, EMS, and search and rescue. And I think what we saw, the debacle we saw during COVID-19, where you had, you know, medical personnel participating in tyranny, it lets me know that I did the right thing by including them too. And the mission of Out of the Gate was to remind them of their oath to the Constitution. Everyone in the United States, from the president down to your local dog catcher, is required to take an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. And also, if they're a state officer, also the state constitution of their state. So, I mean, politicians take it too, but I have zero faith in politicians. I really have zero faith in lawyers. So I focus my mission, focused on the guys that are in military service, law enforcement, first responders. Who I believe have a higher percentage of people that do have sort of honor and courage. That's what I focus on.
When you're talking about the nomination of Ron Paul, is that the year when the TV, the media were doing their thing where he was actually winning and they're saying he's coming third? With all this kind of manipulation, or was that another political run?
That's part of it. It was for the primary.
Yep.
And like I said, I believe that if they had run fair primaries, that Ron Paul would have won it. Just like the Democrats stole their primary from Bernie Sanders. Of course, Bernie Sanders is a horrible communist. He's horrible. But the point is that, you know, both parties in the United States pay lip service to being, you know, democratic.
Yeah.
And having their grassroots decide who the nominee is going to be. That's just not reality. The reality is usually they pick the nominee. And if you are not playing the game, if you're not one of them, they'll find a way to cheat you out. I think Trump has been an exception to the rule. I think he has been able to, you know, maneuver himself within the party system and still come out with a nomination. But I think that he probably made a deal. The deal he probably made, the same deal was made by Reagan, that, well, okay, we'll let you have the nomination, but you have to take our VP pick. And in Reagan's instance, it was Bush, right? And of course, they tried to kill him to put Bush in. They got tired of him. And with Trump, it was Mike Pence.
Mike Pence.
Who turned out, you know, I knew from the very beginning, Mike Pence was a horrible globalist and establishment type. So I was already awake and aware about him. But others, they were fooled by him because he says he's a Christian. You know, he wraps himself in Christianity as his way to cover for his crimes.
Well, comment, when you made that comment about you were aware Mike Pence was a globalist. Could you give us any hints, any thoughts on that?
I knew he was, what was the, I forgot what it was called, the Trans-Pacific partnership.
TTP. Yeah.
Yeah. He was very much in favor of that. And also in Indiana, where he's from, he was a huge supporter of red flag bills. You know, and they touted Indiana's red flag bill as the national model that should be adopted across the country. And Mike Pence was pushing in the Trump administration that to be the standard.
Is that in regard to firearms?
Yes, that's what you call a red flag bill. It basically allows a judge an ex parte hearing, which means you have no knowledge it's even happening. You're not there. You're not allowed to speak on your own behalf. And they just decide that you're a danger, potential danger to others, and they come take your firearms. So you have to then fight, hire a lawyer, pay about $10,000. You get your firearms back if you ever get them back at all. So it's a complete violation of due process and also a violation of the Second Amendment. So it's horrible. And so, but that's what Mike Pence stands for. And he even got Laura Trump, I believe, to go on a tour with him, advocating for more red flag bills across the country. So there's an example of why Mike Pence is, like I said. And Bill Barr is the same way. Bill Barr was in favor of red flag bills as well, and also in favor of the assault weapons ban back in the day. First time he served as Attorney General, so I was like, "What are you doing? Why are you bringing these people in? These are establishment shills." That's been one of the problems with President Trump. He's doing better this time, but he still has establishment globalist shills in his circle. He still has Bushites around him right now.
And I want us to talk about try and remember to talk about that. I think that would be really good, because what about? I mean, it's interesting you mentioned Bill Barr. Was Bill Barr, did he know Robert Mueller of the Mueller investigation extremely well? Were there sort of tie-ups there?
Because I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised. I just know he's been a deep insider inside the Beltway for a long time. So I wasn't at all surprised that at the very end, he backstabbed the president and didn't do what he wanted to do. Of course, he's going to do what the deep state wants him to do. He's part of that.
That is very interesting what you said about Reagan. If you go further, we go not further back, just beyond that. What, it all depends where you were at that time, but what are your thoughts on the whole Al Gore, you know, George Bush Jr. standoff in that election in 2020, considering the comment, quite rightly, the comments about the it being stolen in 2020, and as I want to go on to, you very kindly mentioned Tina Peters and the awful situation he's in. Just wondering what your reflections are on that.
Oh, it's directly related, because in 2000, the Supreme Court stepped in through Article 2. They said, you can't just do what you want in Florida. You have to follow Florida election law. And so they said Article 2, same thing I just told you, and same thing John Eastman, President Trump's attorney, said, it's not rocket science. Article 2 is pretty clear. It says state legislatures have the authority to determine the manner of processing electors. Nobody didn't mention anybody else, just state legislatures. And state legislatures in this country historically in the past had just directly voted for the electors for president. So there was no popular vote for the then turned into the electors are tied to the popular vote. It was just a state electors. The state representatives got together and voted for the electors to be president. So they retain the authority to do it any way they want to. They can do that again. They take back their authority to pick their electors themselves, which is what they should have done during a so-called pandemic where you can't have a popular vote in a normal election. They could have said, well, because of the pandemic, we're just going to sit together on a Zoom call and we'll pick the electors. They could have done that. That would have been constitutional. What was not constitutional is them doing nothing, sitting on their hands, and then allowing election officials in the executive branch in the state or down to the county level or even town level, precinct level, or judges to just do what they wanted to do. This is what happened. So in 2000, the Supreme Court did a duty and stepped in and enforced, through Article 2, enforced the election law of Florida. It said, here's how you have to count those hanging chads. You got to do it pursuant to the clear law established by the state of Florida, by the legislature. In 2020, that's what should have happened. In fact, Texas, Attorney General Paxton from Texas, sued Pennsylvania, alleging that they had violated, which they had, their own state election laws. And other states joined the lawsuit. And Texas's argument was, by you not following your state election laws, you triggered a violation of Article 2. It's unconstitutional. So the election was not only unlawful in all these states, they voted, they directly violated state election law. It was also unconstitutional. It didn't follow Article 2's mandate. That when one state sues another, that's under the original jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court is the trial court for that case. You don't have to sue going to some federal district court judge in a state and then wind up, you know, going to the appellate courts and then to the Supreme Court. It goes straight to the Supreme Court or the trial court. This means that with the Supreme Court being the trial court, they don't have the discretion to say no, like they would if someone were appealing to them for a writ of certiorari. They can deny it. They can just deny it. No reason given. But when they're the trial court, they're the trial court. So Alito and Thomas were the only two justices on the Supreme Court who said, hey, time out. We have to take this case. It's under our original jurisdiction. But all the other judges, including the other so-called conservative judges, Roberts, Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett, they sided with the leftists and just ducked their responsibility. They refused to hear the case. Alito and Thomas were like, this is ridiculous. We have to hear this case. But they refused to do it. That's what threw us into a constitutional crisis. So unlike in 2000, when the Supreme Court did their job in 2020, they sat on their hands and refused to do their job and left this country in a constitutional crisis. That's why we had to fall back on members of Congress to challenge the slates, that these slates were blatantly unconstitutional. And not only were they unconstitutional, they were, like I said, illegal under state election law. So the state legislatures should have been required to do their job, to either directly select their electors, which is what would have been an easy solution, or to hold a new election if they had to. That was the argument that was given by John Eastman. The slate should be rejected and sent back to the state legislatures to do their job under Article 2. And I agree with that. I think that's constitutionally sound. If the Supreme Court had ever heard the cases, they would have obviously ruled that way too. It's just plain black letter law from the Constitution itself. But instead, they ducked the responsibility. And so you have the media and all the talking heads saying that, well, no court has ever sided with President Trump's arguments. That's only because the Supreme Court were cowards and refused to do their duty. And this is important because it ties in with the riots throughout the United States. They were burning down cities, and that, I think, was an important backdrop, because the rumor from an insider inside the Supreme Court is that Roberts yelled and screamed when they were talking to each other about this case, yelled and screamed at Alito and Thomas and said, if we take this case and then rule in favor of President Trump, then they'll burn our cities down across the country. That's what Roberts told them. I believe that's probably true. So the terrorism of the communists in the streets throughout 2020 actually was effective, because it caused the weenies on the Supreme Court, like Roberts, to disregard their duty and betray their oath and sit on their hands and do nothing to defend the Constitution and let the rubber stamping of a puppet go forward. And that's why we were there in Washington on January 6, 2021. It was a protest, an obviously illegal and unconstitutional election, and a coup. So we're anti-coup. We're counter-coup. They're the ones who wanted to do it.
I hear you, and you've just explained that absolutely brilliantly, and segue into Jan 6, but just roll back a minute. So Roberts was already on the Supreme Court. Trump didn't nominate Roberts, did he? But he did nominate Kavanaugh and Barrett.
That's right, yeah.
And I suppose that was the shock, that those two folded. Is that a fair comment?
Yeah, I was not surprised at Roberts folding, but Kavanaugh and Barrett were definitely a disappointment, yes. Although I'm cynical already about the Republican Party. I've seen it so many times over and over again. It wasn't a great shock.
No.
Sadly, because, yeah.
Because as our mutual friend David Summerall says, it's two wings of the same bird. It's just taken a long time. We have the same over here. It's taken a long time.
I think it was Pappy Cannon first said that the Republican Party and Democratic Party, the left and the right, so-called, are just two different wings of the same bird of prey. I think that's absolutely true. I call it the uniparty. Like a unibrow, you got a uniparty.
Yep. Yep. No, absolutely. So going to Jan 6, we're leading up to that. So that is why people went and protested you just brilliantly, given all of the background to that. And of course, that then got lost in the mist, didn't it? It then got lost in the deflection of mm-hmm. what the Democrats then created in turning around and saying this is the biggest threat to our democracy, etc. I didn't think you were a democracy. I thought you were a constitutional republic with inalienable rights.
That's right. We are. We are a constitutional republic. But they always sweep that under the rug. The word democracy, it does drive me nuts when people use that term. Mm. It's nowhere in the Constitution, nowhere in our Bill of Rights, nor is it anywhere in our Declaration of Independence, nor is it anywhere in our Articles of Confederation. It's nowhere in any of our organic instruments that started this country. So, no, it's not part of our law. But it's shorthand for Republican rule, which means the people elect their representatives. But we're, like you said, we're a constitutional republic. It's not just majority rule. I mean, the UK is a representative democracy, I would take it, right? So your state, your legislature, your House of Parliament and House of Lords can, if they want to, pass really any law. You don't really have a constitution above. That's a super, super law above them. The will of
you're quite right. As right. long as there are a number of, they have got the amount of members of parliament they need. Absolutely right. And right. as you would then say that one of the problems about a democracy is that it's actually mob rule. And just to give you a little figure, in our last election of 4th of July, it was, I think, deliberately chosen last year, 39.8% of people didn't actually vote because they were so disillusioned. Mm-hmm. And that is where we have reached. But you're right. And I throw out that whole thing of democracy because when they have constantly come out with that, it's driven me up the wall as well.
Right.
As in, you may use democratic, e.g. everyone has the right to vote as long as you are a legal citizen. And registered. That's another subject, in one sense, which is what you've suffered from over the last 4 years. So on the day of January 6th, there you are. The Oath Keepers are there. What were your observations, and what did you do? What happened, Stuart?
So what happened is that just like in November and December, the plan was for folks to be at this massive rally that President Trump had put together next to the White House there. But then after it was over, to march to the Capitol, like they had done in November and December, for additional events all around the Capitol. That's why it drives me crazy when the media to this day spins it as though everyone was going to be at President Trump's rally at the Ellipse until he suddenly told them to go to the Capitol. Then his followers all marched to the Capitol under his orders and attacked democracy. It's just garbage. They were already planning on going up to the Capitol, as they had done many times before, for additional speeches. And back in November and December, by the way, there were no restrictions on being on the grass of the Capitol lawn. We filled the entire grass. It was just full of people. It was massive crowds. So when January 6th rolled around, a lot of the people that came from the Ellipse rally or President Trump's rally, who then marched toward the Capitol, by the time they got there, there were no bike racks up, no signs saying you can't enter the Capitol grounds. They didn't know they were standing on, you know, prohibited grounds, because they had suddenly changed. Before, they allowed folks to be on the grass, and now they decided it was not going to be prohibited space. So that's part of the entrapment of January 6th, just by you walking onto the Capitol lawn without knowing you're on restricted territory. You're now, you know, so-called accused of a crime. So that's a lot of the people that were initially arrested and had their homes raided by the FBI at gunpoint were just simply standing on the grass.
Yes.
You know, in a place that they didn't even know was restricted grounds. So just that's an important point, I think. But President Trump, in his speech, he said, now you're going to go to the Capitol. That's because he knew they were already planning on doing that. He didn't say, now I want you to go to the Capitol.
Absolutely.
He said, now you're going to go to the Capitol, and I'll be there with you. I believe that's very likely he wanted to go speak at the same event that Marjorie Taylor Greene was going to speak at. Ali Alexander's event right outside the East Side doors was going to have Marjorie Taylor Greene, Josh Hawley, Louie Gohmert, other members of Congress were going to speak there after their deliberations on the electoral slates. And also they're going to have a keynote speaker, Roger Stone, who's going to be the keynote speaker at that event. I think it's highly likely that's what President Trump meant. I think he did want to go to that rally, but I believe the Secret Service talked him out of it. I think that's true. I don't believe the nonsense that he tried to wrestle the steering wheel. That was all obviously a bunch of nonsense they made up, trying to make him look like a wild-eyed crazy man. So just the reality is, best way to look at January the 6th is a manipulated event. They knew the pattern already of Trump supporters marching from wherever they were down by the White House, you know, up to the Capitol. They knew that pattern. Happened in November, happened in December, was already planned. They already knew there's permitted events around the Capitol. So if you're a bad guy in deep state and you want to create a Reichstag fire moment to distract from what you're doing, this is just like the Nazis with the Reichstag fire, right?
Yeah.
They set the Parliament of Germany on fire. Later on, historians pretty much prove it with the Nazis themselves. They lit it up on fire, burned it to the ground, blame it on the communists, and then blame it on internal enemies and began, you know, their dictatorship on that ground. I think it's very much the same here. They pulled a coup, cover for it. They created a fake insurrection by manipulating the crowd into entering the Capitol, by focusing the cameras on a few people who were fighting with the police. And how do you get Trump supporters to fight with cops? I mean, most Trump supporters are overwhelmingly pro-law enforcement. Well, how do you get people like that to fight with police? You have police using excessive force, especially against women and children. That's what happened on the West Side. Well, I wasn't there. I was on the East Side trying to find my security teams. But here's what happened with us. Our Florida team was assigned to escort Ali Alexander's speakers from the Ellipse rally, and they were down in the VIP section with their protectees. They were assigned to watch them there and then escort them on foot to the Capitol, to Area 8, that east side grass outside the Capitol doors, for their event, for Ali Alexander's event. That's what they did. They escorted them up there, but by the time they got there, the crowds had already pushed over the bike racks and gone up the steps. And so their protectees ran up the steps too. And so they went up the steps with their protectees to protect them. And then the east side doors were opened from the inside by somebody yet to be identified. It's funny how that always works. So you don't yet know who opened the inside doors, right, for the east side doors. But they opened from the inside, and then our guys were funneled in along with the rest of the crowd. Like a toothpaste tube. And you stomp on it, it all comes out, right? So when the crowd's rushing in like that, it's really difficult for you to how are you gonna fight the crowds? You wind up inside the Capitol. That's what happened to our team. And they went in, I believe it was about 20 minutes after others had already entered from the West Side, and it was through doors open from someone else. You know, the media spins it as though the Oath Keepers, you know, led the assault on the Capitol. So, but they went in 20 minutes after somebody else already been inside. They didn't lead anything. And they walked through doors that were already open from the inside by somebody else. They didn't breach anything. You know, the media is always like, you know, the Oath Keepers breached the east side doors like we had a battering ram or something.
Yeah.
It's just they walked through the doors when they opened by somebody else. So it's just complete garbage. And we went inside, they held a prayer circle, and then they helped police. They actually helped the police officer, Harry Dunn, who was in a hyper-adrenalized state, had his M4 rifle in his hands, was yelling and screaming at Trump supporters. And it was pretty obvious to the military veterans on that team that he was about ready to snap and shoot people. So they got in between. They put their backs to Harry Dunn, put their hands out towards the Trump supporters he was yelling at, and they dialed it all down and de-escalated the confrontation. And I think they calmed Harry Dunn down. I don't believe the Trump supporters ever were a real threat to Harry Dunn at all, but I think he was definitely a threat to them. So our guys de-escalated that situation and probably avoided more loss of life. Because Ashley Babbitt had already been murdered.
Yeah.
To this day, that police officer who shot an unarmed woman, a veteran, in the face, has yet to be held accountable.
Yeah.
So but imagine if Harry Dunn had opened fire with his M4 with a 30-round magazine. He could have killed dozens of Trump supporters. So I'm glad my guys did that. And Harry Dunn, originally, when he first did his first interview with the FBI, admitted that the Oath Keepers had helped him. But by the time they got to trial in November of 2022, they put him on the stand at our trial. They, of course, his story had changed. It turned into, oh, that was some other group of people dressed like that who had helped me. I was mistaken. It wasn't the Oath Keepers. The Oath Keepers, in fact, were hostile and threatening. You know. And then he says, oh, and Officer Lazarus was with me and saw how hostile and threatening they were. So then they brought Officer Lazarus up on the stand, And he was one of the officers in charge of Nancy Pelosi's personal security detail.
Right.
That's an important point. So Officer Lazarus gets up on the stand and says, oh, yeah, I saw this dangerous confrontation where the Oath Keepers were threatening Officer Dunn, and they were not helping him. They were threatening him. That's what they both said at trial. But later it was discovered in footage found by Steve Baker from Blaze TV. He found footage of Officer Lazarus under the Senate building in the tunnel at that time. So he was not where he said he was. So they were both lying on a stand. They both committed perjury.
Is he the gentleman that was wearing a long, dark coat?
No, I think he's wearing a suit. Lazarus was. He might have an overcoat.
And the guy that shot Dear Ashley. Is
Michael Byrd.
Yeah. It's right. Important we put that name out.
Yes, he's the police officer, another black officer. These are all three black officers, which shouldn't matter, except if you're a black nationalist BLM supporter who hates Trump supporters and you're a racist, then it does matter. I think Michael Byrd fits those categories. I think he's a white hating racist pro Black Lives Matter zealot who took advantage of the situation to shoot a Trump supporter and get away with it. That's what I think.
Well, let's just remind ourselves, because Dear Ashley Babbitt died that day. We then have Kevin Greeson, Benjamin Phillips. We have under different circumstances, but still right. Neglect. But then again, when the police are going to fire smoke bombs and rubber bullets into a crowd, there are consequences of that.
Right.
Their bodies being shocked by that. And then dear Roseanne Boyland and Philip Anderson right. Tried to save her life at that
well,
point.
Roseanne Boyland's a good example of excessive force. So you have an unconscious woman laying on the ground, and yeah. Then you have a female officer hitting her in the head with a club.
Myla Morris, I think.
Right. Yep. That's obvious excessive force. Police officers are taught that you can only strike someone in the head with an impact weapon like a baton or a club if they're a lethal force threat to yourself or someone else. Mm-hmm. Because you hit them in the head, they could die. It's lethal force. And an unconscious woman laying on the ground is obviously not a lethal force threat to anyone, yet she's being struck in the head over and over again. That's an example of the kind of excessive force that the men who were there saw with their own eyes that caused them to then step in and try to grab her baton or otherwise fight the cops. That's how you get Trump supporters by police. You have police do things that are dishonorable and excessive force and actually crimes in right in front of you. And then any man worth his salt is going to step in and try to protect.
I mean, we go back to the work of our dear friend David Summerall, where he shows in the timeline where I think either at 5-6 minutes past one, when Ted Cruz are told to stand up to actually talk about this needs to go back to the Electoral College, this needs to go back to individual states to look at, and asking Mike Pence, well, what do we do here? What's the legality here? Mm-hmm. And then next second, they're firing the rubber bullets and the smoke grenades into the crowd. And as David Work has said, you know, and you quite rightly refer to this, where the crowd are going, why are they firing at us? We backed the blue. In his first film, you hear those words very, very clearly.
Yeah, I think they were told to. And unfortunately, in this country, sadly, many police just follow orders because they don't want to lose their job. They do what they're told, whether it's standing down and letting Antifa attack Trump supporters, of which we saw, like in downtown Berkeley, California. That's why we had to jump in, did it twice, protecting events in the Martin Luther King Park in Berkeley, California. But the first time we watched it live stream on the internet, and the police just backed away under orders and did nothing. Antifa came in the clubs and beat people, put people in the hospital. So that was a big wake-up call that police in this country, sadly, because they're afraid to lose their jobs, they'll just follow orders, just like the Nazis did in World War II.
I hear you.
It's human nature. So, yes, I think there were... Here's how you do it. You have agitators in the crowd, urging the crowd forward, urging the crowd to go inside. So one of our attorneys for my co-defendants, he found Brad Geyer, really good attorney, he used to be a prosecutor. he found video of teams in the crowd that you can watch, very coordinated, very well-planned teams that were going around, making sure the windows got broken, making sure people got in, then they go somewhere else to do the same thing again. So that was a very coordinated effort. It wasn't just spontaneous from the crowd. So you have people in the crowd, urging them forward, making sure they get inside. You have Ray Epps, you know, telling people to go inside the Capitol. Of course, he never gets indicted. Until later, he's hit with a slap on the wrist with a misdemeanor, right? So that's how you do it. You have agitators in the crowd, and then you have special teams, I believe, inside the police force who are given a green light and told to use excessive force and let them know that, hey, don't worry, we'll take care of you, which they have. Michael Byrd, the one who murdered Ashley Babbitt, was promoted. Everybody was failed upwards. All these people that committed all these acts of violence against Trump supporters, excessive force, as far as I know, none of them have been disciplined. In fact, they've been hailed as heroes.
Wasn't there, and David had very much pointed this out to me as well, where under that whole thing of Governor Whitmer, when she said she was kidnapped and three quarters of them are members of the FBI, and then that chief there then gets sent to the Capitol, wasn't he then promoted?
Right. He was, that's right. They brought the man who created the fake kidnap plot, it was an FBI plot against Whitmer. They brought him to Washington, D.C. ahead of January the 6th. So, of course, he's going to do the exact same thing for January the 6th. I believe that he did. He went in there, and you know, as far as I know, I don't think he's been fired yet either from the FBI. Right. Or did he retire? I can't remember.
So, Stuart, how then did it unfold for you? It just seems very sad. And also, Officer Signick, you know, sadly suffering from health issues, taken to the police lines by patriots to say we can actually look after him, we have medical training, etc., and then he dies and then is given this incredible I'm not being disrespectful, but I just think used and given this incredible funeral, and then the press are saying that he got killed by having a fire extinguisher smacked through his head.
That's not true. Yeah, so no police died that day. Only Trump supporters died. And yet the media and the prosecutors continue to lie. In fact, at my sentencing, they brought out the chief of staff for Nancy Pelosi. And that chief of staff got on the stand and lied and said officers had died that day. So it's really strange to be in this alternate reality. It's like being in Orwell's 1984. Truth is whatever the party says it is. Mm-hmm. And anything else is dismissed as a lie. And the judges are part of the party, prosecutors are part of the party, all the police are now part of the party. It's all a one party. The media, it's all one big party. There's different fingers of the same fist. And they all have their job, but it's all consistent. In fact, the false narrative was set back on February the 16th, 2021, when Benny Thompson's member of Congress from Mississippi, and Benny Thompson sued President Trump, Rudy Giuliani, Oath Keepers and Proud Boys on February 16, 2021, along with other members of Congress, alleging a conspiracy with Trump and the Kingpin to attack democracy. That's how early this false narrative was set. That was just weeks after January the 6th. They couldn't have gone through any kind of actual investigation into anything, but that's the narrative. And everything else that they did was meant to make that narrative true. That's why they held the J6 Select Committee, headed by Benny Thompson. And all it was a Hollywood production to cherry pick and manipulate. And of course, they suborned perjury, they coached perjury. They, you know, they had a conspiracy to commit perjury, and they had perjured witnesses getting up on the stand, testifying in front of Congress. All very well all curated. I offered to testify, but I said I want it live in front of C-SPAN cameras. I'll talk about J6. But nope, they wouldn't have me come in there and do that. They only had people that they filmed. They picked out their people they knew that would lie and coach them to get up there and lie. And something important to note is that Ray Epps was a leader of Oath Keepers back in Arizona in 2009 and 2010. And then he resigned and said he had too much work to do with his family business. And we didn't even see him again ever until I saw footage after January 6th of him on the night of the 5th, January 5th, in the streets of D.C., urging people to go into the Capitol. You know, like, tomorrow we got to go into the Capitol. And then on January the 6th, he's, you know, saying, "They're, you know, go towards Capitol. That's where your problems are." And then he's on video right before Ryan Samsel pushed over the first bike rack, where he whispers in his ear. Well, when they came to the J6 Select Committee, Ray Epps disappeared. He's not in any footage. They cut him out. They show Ryan Sampson pushing over the bike rack, but they don't show Ray Epps whispering in his ear just seconds before. They cut that out. They never mention him. You would think if they had a Oath Keeper chapter leader, even if he's former of a state chapter, on camera saying, go into the Capitol tomorrow, you think they would have used that all over the media, and he would have been sitting next to me at trial, right? Because it'd be like, here's a golden opportunity to say the Oath Keeper had a plan. Because he was on film doing what I was accused of, articulating a plan to enter the Capitol and encouraging other people to do it. I didn't do that, but he did, and yet he wasn't prosecuted at all. So this goes to show you, I believe he was a Fed. I think it's pretty friggin' obvious by now that he was part of the setup, or that they liked that narrative and wanted to use it, but they didn't want to actually charge him. I'm not sure which one it is. I think it's more likely that he was part of it.
So when we're in the last sort of 10 minutes to it, and thank you, your explanation is incredible. I mean, some of that I know.
But I bring that up only to say that at our trial, we were not allowed to show the footage of Ray Epps.
Right.
We're not allowed to even mention his name to the jury. So consistently throughout, he was protected and shielded from scrutiny.
When you went into court, when were you arrested? Was it later on in 2021 or
22? 22. February, right. January 13th, 2022. Because right. I didn't enter the Capitol.
Yep.
And I didn't fight with any police.
Yep.
And so they had to go and they had to cook up fake testimony to justify arresting me. There were two Oath Keepers who were coerced into pleading guilty to seditious conspiracy. I think they're cowards. They just lost their courage and agreed to take that deal and dishonor themselves by doing that because it helped further the false narrative. Now the media said, oh, look, two Oath Keepers have admitted there was a plan. And then they signed a fake statement of facts that said that I had told them to go inside the Capitol. Completely false. So I think it was only after they had cooked up false testimony that they could justify arresting them. So yes, I was arrested January 13, 2022, and I was held in solitary confinement all the way through from that day on. Even though my only priors were traffic tickets, like speeding tickets, they decided that I was somehow so dangerous that I shouldn't be allowed to be free. And I was held in solitary confinement. And that was done pre-trial, during trial, and even after my trial. And the entire time, I'm a Yale Law graduate, but never, not once, did I have access to a law library, no computers, look up case law to help with my own defense. They made sure that I was kept from being able to do that. So, but the goal was to coerce us into a false testimony. We were all threatened with life in prison, and they told us, I got a letter from the prosecutor saying, because this is us, this is really analogous to treason, we're going to ask the judge for life in prison, and you have, you know, X number of days to make a deal. That was their offer. And I just flushed that thing down the toilet myself. That's where it belonged. So I refused to make a deal. So those of us who refuse to make a deal, I think this is important. Like Ron Paul said, truth is treason in the empire of lies. And so we were punished for sticking to our guns and telling the truth. Looked the jury right in the eye and told him that election was stolen and unconstitutional. At my sentencing, looked the judge right in the eye and told him I'm a political prisoner. Like President Trump, my only crime is opposing those who are destroying our country. I also told him I can't shut my eyes to the plain text of Article 2 and what it requires. That's why that was an unconstitutional election. And I was hit with 18 years in prison. So the guys that rolled over and pled guilty to seditious conspiracy didn't see a day in prison. They were given only probation only by that same judge. In December of 2024, he finally sentenced them. So after the election, he finally sentenced them to probation only. So they were rewarded for their lies, participating in the big lie. I was punished for telling the truth. So that's why I add a corollary to what Ron Paul said. Truth is treason in an empire of lies, but lies are loyalty in an empire of lies, is what I would also add to that.
And hence why you've made that reference to Alexander Solzhenitsyn,
right,
to live not by lies.
That's right. And that's the first step in a resistance, is not participate in the lie. Right.
Stuart, what is, I do apologize because we're so restricted by time, but I want to, when you're free, I want to be able to sit down with you again.
Sure.
Because your explanation is just brilliant. because many people would never have heard this at all. The press over here wouldn't go near it, and it isn't because of lack of trying. I can tell you that. Yeah. So when yeah, you
not,
went
not
into
even Fox News in this country would ever touch that story.
Yeah, absolutely.
No way. Yeah.
When you went into court, what did they say to you about your constitutional rights?
Well, I'll put it this way. In this country, you're supposed to be presumed innocent until proven guilty by a jury of your peers, and that needs to be an impartial jury, and needs to be in a court with an impartial judge who will check your rights. None of that was true for any of us. There's no way any Trump supporter is going to get a fair trial in Washington, D.C. Not only because it's like overwhelmingly Democrat, he's a partisan leftist, but also because the courts themselves describe Washington, D.C. and all of its residents as the victims of January the 6th. And so they insisted on drawing the jury pool from the so-called victim pool. It'd be like if you were accused of robbing a 7-Eleven, but they drew the jury from everyone who was in the 7-Eleven that night, you know. So you're not going to get a fair trial. But every motion for a change of venue was denied. And I believe, of course, the reason for that is they want to ensure our guilty pleas or ensure our coerce us into guilty pleas or ensure that we're convicted. But also, they don't want to deny any precedent to President Trump. Because remember, they charged him January 6th also in Washington, D.C. They charged him with one of the same crimes they charged us with, you know, the obstruction of official proceeding, 1512. It was later thrown out by the Supreme Court. But that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to put him in prison. So they didn't want any precedent of a change of venue, you know, moving the trial outside of D.C. So we were all, you know, we all knew there's no way we're going to win. It's just a matter of personal honor. We're not going to bend the knee or kiss the ring. We're not going to agree to plead to something we did not do, and nor are we going to bear false witness. All my co-defendants are people of honor. Yeah.
So,
and same goes for the Proud Boys, the ones that started their guns. And ironically, there's 14 of us, all of us who went to trial, refused to bend the knee and participate in the lies. We were commuted only, not pardoned. We still await pardon. But the oath keepers that took those deals and dishonored themselves, they got a pardon, which is bizarre. So they didn't see any jail time, but they were also pardoned. Those of us who are loyal to President Trump instead received commutation instead of pardon. And I don't blame him. I think there's someone in his circle that wants that false narrative to continue, and they convinced him to do that. I'm hoping that that will be correctly said.
And the point, I think, to say here is that Dear Enrico gets 25 years, didn't he? And he wasn't even
22 years.
I apologize. Yeah. And he wasn't in nowhere near the vicinity whatsoever.
Right. But he was targeted just like I was. He was the leader of the Proud Boys. Mm. I was the leader of the Oath Keepers. It's all about identity crime, like in the Soviet Union. Show me the man, I'll show you the crime.
His crime, absolutely, absolutely. And I just give you a compliment here, quite rightly, Stuart. Is you know your history. What you've just said there is absolutely, absolutely right. Absolutely brilliant. And I will also say, there is a tie up with what we've seen happen over here, in regard to a certain incident. And there is a tie up. In the last 2 minutes, what is the future for you, Stuart? What's going to happen with the Oath Keepers in the future?
Well, I'm going to relaunch Oath Keepers. And actually, I just finished almost a month of disaster relief in the Texas Hill Country after the deadly flood there. I was boots on the ground starting on July 7th, doing search and we were hoping for search and rescue of live survivors. But by that point, it was just search and recovery of the deceased, sadly. But we've been down there helping. I've been working with Doc Pete Chambers, Special Forces Colonel Retired. He's from Government Ministries, awesome group, and with Buck Up Relief, Jamie and Robert Aguirre, awesome Christian patriots. I've been helping them do disaster relief. But I need to restart Oath Keepers. I mean, just the experience of being down there, I realize it'd be great to have a 40,000 member organization with skilled, trained men on standby to do what we used to do. We used to jump in with both feet for disaster relief. We need to do that again. So I'm going to relaunch Oath Keepers this month. And so I encourage folks, if they want to support that, to go to my Give Some Go and support me in getting it done.
And I will put that in the description. And I do apologize that we haven't had much more time to discuss Texas, what you were doing there. And again,
it'd be a great topic for another interview because
I think that would be that would be really good to do and to pay, you know, talk about that horrendous.
Yeah, there's a lot of good because, you know, just the outpouring of love among Texans and also from other Americans. He had volunteers coming from all over the country. One guy drove down, an Army veteran drove down from Illinois. Another volunteer came all the way from Oregon, a young lady that came and helped us. She was awesome. So it was fantastic. But there's also, of course, tragedy and sadness. And then there's corruption and dereliction of duty and just horrible, I would call it horrible negligence on the part of some of the officials. These were needless deaths, especially the children in the camps down in the river. Did not have to happen. And so state officials and county officials dropped the ball and obviously were not successful because kids died. So I've got very little tolerance for their excuses and finger pointing. So they need to fix it, and hopefully we can get some correction and making sure it doesn't happen again. But I believe the people that are responsible should be held responsible. They should be fired at the very least. So we'll see. But it's the same kind of nonsense we saw in North Carolina and the same kind of nonsense we saw in other disasters where government, at the most, gets in the way, you know, usually. I mean, I'm not talking about the first responders, the search and rescue and firefighters. They're awesome. I'm talking about the bureaucrats. The guys with clipboards almost invariably do nothing but get in the way and cause harm.
I hear you. And you know, we need to remember those families in our prayers and also remember dear Tina Peters in our prayers as well. And for you and what you're doing. Stuart, I do apologize to cut you off as we're just coming to the hour. I'm going to play us out. Please join me on the other side and we'll just say goodbye again. But I just thank you so much for your time. It's been an incredible conversation and thank you for all the information that you have conveyed, which is the truth. So I just want to thank you for joining me.
You bet. I'd love to come back and have a discussion about the parallels between US and the UK.
I think you are the right man to do that with. I can tell you that now. All right. Thank you, my friend.
God bless.
Cheers.